Of the men of God I have known, few have ended well. Many start, but few have ended well. You know, that alarms me a little bit. And I think, well, why is this? And one day I was just reflecting back. I don't know the reasons, but I reflected back on my early days around the Navigators when I was a university student in Baylor University, 1952 to 1956. And we had a very thriving ministry on this campus. There was nothing unusual for our university gang, our teams. When we'd have a Navigator weekend conference, we'd have sometimes 100 or more who would go from this one university. It was a very thriving ministry. And since graduation, I just ever so often hear a little report about where so-and-so is and where so-and-so is. One day it really alarmed me. For instance, the fellow who first gave me a Beginning with Christ packet, it was called B-Ration back then, but the fellow who gave me my first one, someone else gave me one that I didn't memorize, but the first one that I memorized, he gave it to me, and just a short time later, he fell into, it was discovered that he was in very deep moral sin. And the devil really got a major stroke into his life. I think of a fellow on our team back in Baylor that one day I saw this ladder on his Bible, and he said, well, I'll ladder your Bible for you. And I said, would you really? And he said, yes, all I ask is that you come over and watch me so next time you can ladder it for somebody. So I went over and watched him put the ladder on my Bible, and man, I used to sit and hear these guys share the word. And this young fellow graduated from Baylor, went on, became a seminary graduate, and became an assistant pastor in the largest church in all of America, with over 15,000 members. And when I was home in November of 1968 for the regional directors conference there, my heart was crushed when I heard from a fellow friend that now this fellow and his wife were divorced and he's no longer in the ministry. And then there was the fellow on our team that was literally brilliant. When he shared the word, it was amazing the verses he knew and the way he could explain the Bible. In fact, this guy, he had been assigned a term paper, a very heavy, kind of a thesis term paper, in this Bible course on the campus that was being given, and he completely forgot about it. And at 10 o'clock on the night before it was due, he remembered it. So he sat down at his typewriter, and without any notes, without any resource books, without any research, just from past knowledge that he knew, he typed out this term paper and took it and turned it in the next morning, and his professor said it was the greatest work on the subject he had ever seen, and put it in the library for future people to look at on the subject. 2 years ago, I heard that he was now teaching in a university in Old Mexico and was the head of a communist cell group. Then the fellow who was actually in charge of the Navigator ministry on the campus. I remember at the end of my freshman year, I was waiting to go home from my first year. I was kind of lonely, and there weren't many people in the dorm, and all of a sudden I heard a knock at the door, and in came this young fella, and man, did he cheer my heart that night. Brought me an apple. I can still remember him reaching in the sack and said, I thought you might enjoy having an apple. And I took it, and he sat down and listened to me as I shared some of my problems, and we got on our knees and prayed together. And after after he left Baylor, the devil began to really hit him. And I remember one day at Glenary, I was standing on the lawn, and Doss came out of the pink house, and he said, "I have just called so-and-so." And he said, I've never done this before in the history of the Navigators, but I offered him the directorship of, and he named the area one of our most prosperous areas in the United States in ministry-wise. He said, I've never offered so young a man a position, but he said, "I really believe that the devil has both guns turned on this fella." The fella turned it down, and I used to keep correspondence with this fella, and I remember he wrote me one day, and he says, all my life revolves around now is television and sex. And the fellow that was in charge of the Navigator work just before I came to Baylor, he left the year I came. He and his wife were riding along in a car one day, and they had a car accident, and his wife was horribly scarred. And he divorced her and ran off with another lady. Well, fellas, the reason that we even think about this subject tonight is simply this, that the devil is not playing for peanuts, for ground nuts, or whatever you call it. He's not playing for just small coins. He's playing for keeps. And I believe that the reason we need to be interested in this subject tonight is literally the fact that we are at war. In Ephesians 6:10-11 says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." I believe, if I understand that verse correctly, that Satan has this great army, these echelons of leadership, in which they literally have finely worked out strategy on how, as Leroy Imes once said, not that he can just trip you up, but that he can literally grind you to powder. And if 1 Peter 5:8 says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour." And sometimes when you look at the lives of fellows that have violated certain things, and they've kept violating them and kept violating them, and the mercy and the long-suffering of God has gone on, someday the Lord allows Satan to hit. The book of Hosea, God says, "I will reprove Ephraim with a moth." But later on in the book, he says, "I will reprove Ephraim with a lion." And fellows, I'd a whole lot rather a little moth flick me than a lion reach in and take a hunk out of me. The other day down in Nairobi, I picked up the paper, and it told about an African fellow that was riding along one night and apparently had been attacked by a lion. And the next morning they came along, and all they found was his bicycle and some bones. And if you and I tonight knew, if all of a sudden the radio, BBC, came on and said there is a man-eating lion over in the neighborhood of Gurney Court, or I guess at St. Matthias, and he's already destroyed 20 people today, he's eaten them alive, be careful. Well, I tell you, when I go over to the annex tonight, I wouldn't just kind of flip out there. He says, "Be sober." I'd get everything I could, and then when I got to that door, I'd say, "Lee, open it very quickly," and then I'd zip. Because he is out to devour me. Well, who does the devil want to get to? Someone once said, "He who would stand nearest to the captain is the prime target of the archers." He who would stand nearest to the captain is the prime target of the archers. And I believe that when you and I volunteer and we say, Lord, I want to get to the front lines with you. I want to be up where the action is. The Lord says, all right, come on up. But it's dangerous up here. And I believe that the ones that the devil are after, the one that he is after, are those who say, Lord, I'll give you everything. I want to be up where the action is. I want to be near you. And guys, the only reason tonight that we talk on this subject is simply this, that not to scare us or discourage us. I thought of it this way. I asked the Lord this morning, I said, Lord, somehow help this not to discourage or strike fear, or like when I first heard of this fellow that fell into deep moral sin that gave me the B ration. Do you know what my reaction was? I don't know how long it took me to get over that, but I said, boy, Lord, if that godly man couldn't make it, how can I ever make it? They discouraged me. So I was asking the Lord this morning, I said, Lord, how can we put this, how can we case it, so that when we go out, our hearts are filled with reverence, but it doesn't discourage us. And I thought about this. I read about in Vietnam. Let's forget the politics of the war, but just the fact of it, that these soldiers, I was talking with one of the NAV gang that had to be over there for 13 months. He was a platoon leader, and he told how he wouldn't walk on the paths, but how he'd walk beside the paths, because the Viet Cong had dug these holes and they put these sharp spikes down there so that with poison on them, so that when you stepped in, you couldn't even see it. You'd step in, and then it would stick in your leg and poison you. And pretty soon they got boots that wouldn't pierce with that, so the Viet Cong figured that out, and they put the slivers down like this so that when you slipped, your immediate reaction was to jerk, and then you'd jerk back up, and it would get you up high here. And he said, oh, just the agony of not knowing when you were going to step in a trap. And I thought, well, now there's fear if you don't know where the trap is. But if somehow somebody had gone throughout the area where you were going and with paint marked a sign and says, here's one, here's one, here's one, and you knew that all the traps had been marked, man, you just, that would take the fear away. And so, fellas, John said, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. And the purpose of this tonight is simply to enlighten us as to where those traps are that are deadly. When a soldier's out there, a sniper's bullet might simply wound his arm and take him out of action for a while, but there are some attacks of the enemy that blow your head off. And there's some that you don't mistake, that you don't make. Some you make several times, some you only make once. And so, let's tonight just look at the Word of God. Psalm 19:11 says, moreover, by them, that is the words of God, by them is thy servant warned. 1 Corinthians 10:11 and 12 in the Living Letters says, all these things happen to them as examples, as object lessons to us, to warn us against doing the same things. They were written down so that we could read about them and learn from them in these last days as the world nears its end. So be careful. If you are thinking, oh, I would never behave like that, let this be a warning to you, for you too may fall into sin. So, God has given us a book that tells us where every one of those traps are. In 2 Corinthians 2:11, Paul says, for we are not ignorant of his devices. I don't know if you have them up here, but down in East Africa, we have what we call white ants.
You may call them termites in some places. Lauren mentioned them the other day, but we have got more in East Africa than I've ever seen in my life. That's the reason most of the houses are built out of stone, not out of wood. Because the white ants will literally eat out the foundation of your house and will eat the wood, and you can't even tell they're there. I mean, sometimes outwardly, they're on the inside. But if you know where to look, you can tell whether they're there or not. Because there'll be just a little trail of mud. They may be inside this wood, but somewhere approaching that wood will be just a little tunnel of mud. And they tunnel through. And many times I've gone out to a tree or to a fence, and I've noticed that. And now that I know what they do, I have some very deadly poison that I know exactly what to do. I mix it a certain portion with water, and I go out and douse this thing, and that's the end of that. But I can go and just flick that with my finger, and under it are just hundreds and thousands of these little white ants hidden under this little trail of mud. And you find out where it's leading to, and they're just eating out the inside of this. Well, on most of the things that can wreck our lives spiritually, there's this little trail of mud that leads up to it. And if we're sensitive to the Holy Spirit, if He can get through to us, and just touch us with that mud. If we're sensitive, He can warn us. So tonight, let's just look at 9 of these pitfalls that have caused some Christians to have a real setback in their spiritual life. And I think the first one is pride. The sin of pride. Isaiah 42:8. God says, "My glory will I not give to another." And pride, if I understand it correctly, is simply trying to take some of God's glory. Isaiah 66:1 and 2. God says, "But to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. Even to him that is poor and of a broken spirit." So pride is simply refusing to be broken before God. I think this is probably the reason why many times God gives us hardships and difficulties in our life, humiliations. He's the divine chemist, and He knows exactly how much success we can take and how much failure it takes to keep our hand clenched tightly in His, trusting. And a great evangelist and Bible preacher in the early days of America was a man by the name of Charles G. Finney. When I was back in university, I got a book written by him called Revival Lectures, of the Secret of Revival. And man, that was deep waiting. You could only go a paragraph at a time. A very godly man. And in his biography, I read that often after Charles Finney would preach a message, and sometimes hundreds had been saved, and people would repent, and the Spirit of God would really get hold of men and women's hearts. On most occasions, Charles Finney would go home after his message, and he would get down on his face on the floor, and sometimes he would lie there for more than an hour until he was sure that every ounce of idea had left his mind that what had happened that night was a result of his ability instead of God's. He knew the tragedy that could take place in the life of a man who laid his hand to God's glory. You see, this hit Uzziah in 2 Chronicles 26:16. It says that when Uzziah was strong, He was marvelously helped until he was strong. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. In Proverbs 11:2, when pride comes, then comes shame, but with the lowly is wisdom. In Proverbs 16:18, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. I remember back when the first assignment I ever had with the Navigators was in Lincoln, Nebraska, at the University of Nebraska. And we had a young fellow on this campus that he was in his sophomore year when I got there, 19 years of age. And I remember telling Jerry one day that I had never in my life met a young man so young and so able. I'm telling you, when it came to personal evangelism, he could get inside men's hearts in a way that I had never seen before for such a young man. And he had a way, he had a magnetic personality of drawing the team together. And he would sit down and he would strategize as to what each man on the team needed on his team in his dormitory. And, there was no doubt about it, he was the leader. And one day a fellow came to me and he said, "Do you know that so-and-so isn't having a quiet time anymore?" And I said, "Well, no, I hadn't heard that." And he said, I said, what for? What's the reason? And he says, "Well, you better go talk with him." So I went to talk with this fellow, and here he was. He was a star athlete on the basketball team also. Everyone on the campus knew him. And I went and I asked him, I said, "I understand you're not having a quiet time anymore." And he said, "Well, that's right." And I said, "Well, why is that?" And he said, "I just have begun to wonder whether or not my success in the ministry here is a result of my fellowship with God or whether it's just my own personality." And he says, "I've decided to do a 6-week test, have no quiet time, review no verses, do no praying, just to see if it makes any difference." And I said, I called him by name and I said, "Buddy, we don't tempt God like that." I said, "God has told us we need His Word for food to live." And he says, "Well, I know that, but I'm going to try it anyway." So, man, I prayed. But week after week followed. And at the end of the 6 weeks, I came to him and I said, "Well, has it made any difference?" And he says, "Not one bit." I mean, it was very evident to all of us it was making a tremendous difference. And then he began to go sleep with girls. And then he started living with a woman who was a divorcee and had a couple of 3 children. And Lyle Irvin, a young fellow back in the States now in the NAV ministry, was on finance calls and visited in the home of this boy's mother and father, and they're wonderful Christians. And his mother said to Lyle one night when Lyle was there, she said, "I had rather go to my boy's funeral than to see what I'm seeing in his life today." So before pride, or with pride, comes shame and destruction. Dr. Scofield, that did the notes in some of the Bibles that some of you have, once made the comment that most Christians that he knows who have become great men of God have had to pass through 3 trials. And he says that the first trial is the trial of obscurity. And he says many Christians don't pass that because they don't feel they get the credit for what they've done and who they are, and no one recognizes them, no one appreciates them. And so many of them get discouraged and they give up trying to live the effective Christian life. But he says, of those who pass the trial of obscurity, God then sends the trial of popularity. That's when all of a sudden they come into leadership and they are somebody. People listen to them. And he says, here's where the great fallout is. Because not many can take popularity. But he says, of those who pass that test, there's the great test of suffering. And here many fall. But it's this test of popularity that probably brings the pride out of us. And some years ago, one day when Billy was receiving an honorary doctor's degree, and he probably has scores of them by now, almost every university wants to have him on their list of doctor's degree, what you call it. But one day, at one of the universities, where after much praise and honor had been poured out, and the crowd had been told what a contribution this man was making to the world and the world's real problems, Billy Graham stood up to receive the honorary doctor's degree, and here's what he said verbatim. He said, I humbly accept this honor on behalf of the one to whom it rightly belongs. I am merely the vessel, an instrument that God has seen fit to use. I will hold this degree temporarily until he returns, and then together we will give him the honor, the praise, and the splendor that only he deserves. So maybe that's the reason why God can continue to use Billy. Well, I ask myself this. Okay, if this is the problem, popularity begins to come, we become a Christian leader, we have a few men who are answerable to us, and God begins to show us our gift, and we may really be barreling ahead. What can keep me from becoming proud? And I think one thing is to recognize the danger of it and to commit it to God. Ask Him, Lord, don't let me. Several years ago, well, he's with the Lord now, but Joe Blanco came to Glen Eyrie to speak. And he was an associate evangelist on the Billy Graham team at that time. And in one message he gave, he looked right out at us, and he was speaking on a subject similar to this. And he said, pray to God and say, God, beat me, break me, crush me to powder, do anything that's necessary, but don't leave me to myself. And I think if we just tell the Lord, Lord, I'm aware of this danger. And if necessary, give me a thorn in the flesh. But just keep the right spiritual chemistry in my body so that I keep my hand clenched tightly in yours. So one danger, one pitfall out there that gets many. And by the way, when Hugh Mitchell said, of the men of God I have known, few have ended well, he listed some of the things. I've forgotten now his whole list. I know one of them was that men try to be Mr. Big. That's the same thing, pride. Then another one. I believe, fellas, that without a doubt, this trap will leave the deepest scars of probably anything that the devil lays in front of a man of God. It probably leaves the deepest scars, especially with Christian leaders. Now, I know a man today who had a very sordid past, And even in his early Christian days, there was tremendous struggles. But when a man gets up into Christian leadership, I heard a godly man say that this is where the real serious effects come. If a man, once he begins to lead men, and he doesn't guard his sex life. Billy Graham says that the two greatest temptations that he faces are pride and sex. And so much so that Billy has actually vowed that he will not be seen, he will not be caught alone with another woman other than his wife. Hubert Mitchell was talking to a small group of us in Buffalo, New York, about 8 years ago, and he was telling us that in one small town the year before, 1961, that in a small town of 25,000 people, in that 1 year, there had been 8 ministers who had to leave the ministry because of adultery. 8 ministers in one little town. And you see, 1 Corinthians...
Excuse me, I just wanted to... One thing that might need clearing up. Billy Graham said he didn't want to be caught with any other woman. And I thought maybe for some of the English, or some of the non-English, that might seem like he would try to keep it hidden, you know, and wouldn't get caught.
Oh, okay, good, Dad.
Just wouldn't be out in public.
Yes, just so... Because, well, like when he was in Germany, I understand that an article came out and said that Billy Graham was seen last night in a night spot with a beautiful American blonde by the name of Bev Shea. See, the press... Was it in East Germany?
East Germany.
Yeah.
But it's not last when he was in Berlin and they had the trouble with the wall.
Yeah.
Then they try to do this.
Yeah. But see, a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. And Billy just wants to give the Philistines no chance to blaspheme. Proverbs 6:32, or 1 Corinthians 6:18. Says, flee fornication. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, is without the body. But he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. And then Proverbs 6:32 and 33. Proverbs 6:32 and 33. But whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding. He that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. A wound and dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. Well, what can we do? Well, I was thinking through on this for my own life. Now, Lord, here I am, 36. I don't know how many more years I've got in front of me. What principles can I operate on to make sure that the devil doesn't snag on this one? And I just jotted down 3 here. You may know more, but the first one is guard your eyes and your heart. In Genesis 20, verse 6, Abimelech, you remember, was just about to take Sarah as his wife, take her into himself. And God came unto Abimelech in a dream, and he said unto him, yea, I know that thou didst this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore suffered I thee not to touch her. God said, I will not allow you to touch her, because I know you did this in the integrity of your heart. So guys, I don't know how many times that's encouraged me that if I am right with God, if I keep honesty with God, when the time comes that trap is there, and I don't know, all the circumstances look different, and I just fall into it, God will not allow me to touch her. And I think that's what's meant in Psalm 51:6, when David says, "Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and then in the hidden part thou shalt make me to know wisdom." If in the part that I don't know, if in the part that I do know, in my inner parts, I'll be honest with God, then when that time comes when I don't know, I can't see everything, I don't have my guard up, God will give me wisdom. Jerry was talking with a young African girl in the residence hall down in Nairobi a few weeks ago, and the girl had supposedly made a decision, but she just was not getting off the ground spiritually. And Jerry was talking with her one night about scripture memory, and she said she'd tried to memorize but just couldn't, and she read the Bible and it didn't mean anything to her, and Jerry was just scratching her head. And about that time, Sherry came in. Sherry left a pen in the room. And so they all started sorting around trying to find this pen. And Jerry just pulled the curtain back to look on the windowsill there. And right there on the windowsill was this paperback book that had a girl about halfway dressed on it. And the title of the book was "The Girl Who Couldn't Say No." And Jerry just glanced at that and pulled the curtain back, and she said, "Then I knew why this girl was having a hard time memorizing and understanding the Bible." And Jerry discovered a few weeks later that the girl was 4 years pregnant. So guard your eyes and your heart, what you read, what you see. And if our hearts are practicing integrity, God will say to us, "I did not allow you to touch her." And then I think, watch what you... Yes?
What was the reference in Genesis?
20, verse 6. Then I think another suggestion, guys, that can help us on this matter of not falling into moral sin is watch what we touch. I remember Lorne Sanny once saying at the Glen, he said, "I have just marked it down in my book that when I see a man lay his hand on a woman who's not his wife, I just mark it down that but for a miracle of God, that man's going to have trouble." And I remember back in Baylor, we used to go out on some of these weekend evangelistic trips. This wasn't a navigator function. It was kind of a Christian Union function on the campus. Well, it wasn't even Christian Union. It was just different groups of Christians. And we'd go out and preach, and there was this one fellow that I often went with him. I guess I maybe went on 6 weekend trips with him. And I'm telling you, he could preach. When he got that Bible up there, he could preach, and he had a crowd just eating out of his hand. And I remember one day I was sitting in the administration building, and right by a window, it was a beautiful spring day and classes were out, and here came this young, he was a real evangelist. And I saw him walk up to this girl that he was walking along, and just as he got to the window, he put his arms around her and just kind of squeezed her up to himself and said, "Are you going to the revival tonight?" Well, I don't know what happened, but I graduated a year before he did, but I understand in his senior year, one night in his room, something happened, and he stood up in the presence of another guy and took his Bible and just hurled it across the room. And today, he's a judge in a probation court in one of the cities in Texas. I don't know what happened, but I remember looking out and seeing him put his arms around this girl, who, by the way, didn't become his wife. And then a third thing, besides guarding our eyes and watching our touch, is I think evangelism. Sam Shoemaker, who was a pastor in Pittsburgh for years and years, and he was one who really ended well. He once said, I have discovered that any minister who is not involved in personal evangelism will sooner or later be involved in sex sins anywhere from flirtation to adultery. And Hubert Mitchell, if I can come back to him again, I don't think I'll use him anymore. I have forgotten. But anyway, Hube said that he has discovered that whenever he's tempted in the realms of sex, and oftentimes he'll be sitting at his desk working on something, and all of a sudden the devil will come in and all these thoughts. He says, I lay down my pen, I get up, I go out on the streets of Chicago and give my testimony to the first person I can. And he says, the devil goes running. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. Revelation 12:11. But the thing that really speaks to me is this godly man, this pastor, who says, I have seen that any minister or any navigator, he could have said that, who's not aggressively involved in personal evangelism will sooner or later be involved in some kind of sex sin, anywhere from flirtation to immorality. So, sex is a pitfall. This was not what he was referring to, and it's taking it out of the context, but you remember when David said, oh, how the mighty are fallen. That could apply here. Doctrine. Ephesians 4:14. Says that we henceforth be no more children tossed to and fro, carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the sly of men and the cunning craftiness whereby they lie in wait to deceive. And then Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:3-4, he says, preach the word. Be instant, in season, out of season, rebuke, reprove, exhort with all long-suffering and doctrine. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. And 2 Timothy 4, verses 2, 3, and 4, and Ephesians 4:14. I didn't mention this, but this fellow back at the University of Nebraska that said he no longer needed a quiet time, I didn't tell you how that all started, but it was a secular university, and on this campus was a philosophy department, and in the philosophy department they were teaching a course called the Philosophy of Religion. And it was when this fellow started a course in Philosophy of Religion, and he started delving into a lot of higher criticism and things questioning the authority of Scripture, is where I think God, where Satan began to really get him. I think that's where it first entered in. And it's so important for us to have right doctrine. Colossians 2:8 says, beware lest anyone spoil you through philosophy or vain deceit. I remember one of our Baylor team who did go on and is today an outstanding Christian leader. He's not with the Navigators today, but he has a Christian organization of which he is the head of it. He had majored in philosophy in Baylor, but he often told me, he said, Jim, if it hadn't been for my morning quiet time, my hour with God, I would have never made it through that course. And when I first got to Washington, D.C. in 1962, we were having a conference, and a fellow came to me who was on the Navigator staff. He was passing through the area and stopped by the conference ground to see me, and he began to tell me about a new doctrine he had run into and a new thing that he was really excited about. And we were sitting out in front of the dining hall in this conference grounds, and we talked from about 9:30 until for an hour or two. He was telling me all about this thing. And what really alerted me to the danger was when I said to him, I called him by name, and I said, well, don't you think that you ought to tell Lauren about this? You know, if it's a wonderful new discovery, and you ought to better tell Lauren? Let him know about it? He said, no, not necessarily. And one thing led to another, and it just mushroomed until there came a time when, as Ed said, by the way, Ed, that this morning was a tremendous blessing, the idea of mutual respect. See, I think we and the navigators had respect for this fellow, but I don't think he had respect for us. And it just got to where the working relationship was not possible. So I remember Roy Robertson came through when Noel and I were living with Skip Gray in Dallas, and we went out to play golf with Roy one day, and Roy, we were just walking along. I forget what hole we were on, but I was probably playing in the rough, and Roy was out there with me. And Roy said, by the way, Jim, he says, as you grow older as a Christian, one of these days, someone's going to come to you, or you're going to run into something, you're going to say, hey, here's something that the church has been neglecting for 2 centuries. Or here's something the navigators aren't practicing. And he says, remember this. He says, you're not going to run across anything new. And he said, if you come across a little hidden doctrine that you think everybody else is neglecting, but this is really the secret, he says, that'll lead to pride and it'll destroy you. Well, doctrine. Well, this one fella, later on after he left the Navigators, he came back to Washington, D.C., and he was speaking at a banquet. And a couple of friends, very close friends of Jerry's and mine, who went into this particular movement of which the guy was a part, we had been very close to them in the early years of their Christian growth, and they had gone into this. And so we were trying to maintain at least a communication to keep a respect going. And I didn't get to go to the banquet. They invited us to go. I was out of town on a trip or something, but I suggested to Jerry that she go. And this fellow stood up, and he was very kind, and he told what the navigators had meant to him and how they had helped him. But here's what he said. He said, when I first began to be interested in this particular new doctrine, he called it what it was, he said, I was in my area, and I was tremendously discouraged. And he said, I couldn't pray. My tongue was heavy. I couldn't pray. And I was dry day after day. And then he said, then this happened, and went on with his testimony. But I thought to myself that we need to beware of discouragement. Now, I am not saying that what this fellow is emphasizing is of the devil. But I think we need to beware in times of discouragement, in times of deep depression, of all of a sudden finding something that nobody else has told me, and here's the secret, unless it's just Jesus. I read about Hudson Taylor, and I read about some of these fellows, the Exchange Life, in J.O. Frazier's book, too. And what happened was, in their time of deep depression, or times of deep discouragement, it was when they came to realize that it's Jesus in me, the hope of glory, that lifted them out of that pit and enabled them to walk with constant joy. So, let's just be careful that we don't get discouraged. And I think another thing that can help us on this is that if we do feel we've discovered something, man, let's go tell our leadership about it. Just be open about it. And I think for those of us who are leaders, we need to know the state of our flock, so that if they are discouraged, we stay close to them. Doctrine. Then here's one that I don't think needs a great deal of comment. Lauren has already commented on it and others this week. But it is true that the devil often gets someone on this matter of bitterness. Now, I did a little study on this matter of bitterness, and I discovered that four times in the New Testament bitterness is mentioned. If you just want the references, it's in Acts 8, about verse 23, and then in Hebrews 12, 14 and 15, and Ephesians 4, 30 and 31, and Romans 3:14. As far as I know, those are the only four times in the New Testament where bitterness is mentioned. And Hebrews 12:14 says, "Looking diligently, lest any root of bitterness springing up seem to trouble you, and thereby many be defiled." And he uses the word root of bitterness. And probably what that is referring to is a plant that grew in the Middle East at that time called wormwood. It was a plant with a root system in a plant, and it was very, very bitter. And I looked up this about wormwood, and I discovered there were three characteristics of wormwood. One is that it grows in desolate places. It grows in desolate places. Secondly, it's bitter tasting or obnoxious to the taste. And then thirdly, it's poisonous if drunk. If you drink it, it's poisonous. The sap from it. And I thought, well, maybe that's probably what Paul was talking about in Hebrews 12. Because most of the time when bitterness comes, it comes when we're beginning to feel sorry for ourselves and we're lonely. And here you find Simon, this sorcerer in Acts 8. It says he was a great one and greatly acclaimed, and everyone was coming to him. And when Philip came in and preached, he just stole his glory. And Simon came and wanted to buy this gift. And Peter said to him in Acts 8, he said to him, "For I perceive that thou art in the gall of bitterness and in the bond of iniquity." And so often, fellas, this is when it happens. And I know this, that when I begin to feel sorry for myself and I begin to feel lonely, boy, that's when the temptations come to feel resentment. So-and-so had no right to say that to me. And why did he do that to him? And I began to get subjective. And I'll bare my heart tonight. I think that of any of these that I fear, and I know that I have the capacity for, it's this one. Because bitterness is the exact opposite of meekness. If you're meek, you can just take your problem and cast it on the Lord and turn it over to the Lord to take care of it. But boy, so often, guys, I want to fight my own battles. And then to the life that becomes bitter, and he just pours this out to people, he loses that sweet fragrance of his life. And his life really is obnoxious to everyone that comes around, because he's just got this one little thing he's playing. How so-and-so is mistreated, and on and on. And it just makes our life obnoxious. And then the problem is that he says it poisons, that many be defiled. I remember one day in Washington, D.C., I'd just gotten there, and one day I got a phone call from a fellow in the area who had once been with the Navigators, and for 1 hour, I could hardly get a word in. For 1 hour, he just raked me over the coals as to what was wrong with the Navigators. And then I think, be forgiving. Ephesians 4:32 says, "And be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you." And boy, if there was anyone who had the right to be bitter, it was Joseph. All the raw deals he got from his brother, then from Potiphar's wife, then from this, what was it, a butler or baker? Which one was it? The butler or the baker who had said he'd remember him? And man, he just, for years and years, he was getting the raw end of the deal. But he could look his brothers in the eye in Genesis 45:8, and he said, "It wasn't you that sent me here, but God." So to be forgiving and to see God above our circumstances. Sometimes the things that cause resentment in my heart, when I've had a chance to back away and look at them objectively, I've seen, well, maybe God allowed that just to teach me some meekness or humility. Maybe it wasn't right, but God can use any kind of any old instrument He wants to teach me anything He wants. So to be forgiving. I remember one day I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This was about 12 years ago. And a fella told me a story. I'm telling you, he was bitter. For an hour or more, we sat around a little coffee table, and he just poured out how he had been mistreated by a certain navigator. And I remember going away thinking, man, is he bitter? You know what? About 6 years later, I went back through Pittsburgh, and I met this fella, and he was so loving. And he came out to a NAV conference, and he brought carloads of people out. And I thought, I asked him, I says, "What happened?" And it was just this, that he realized that God had been in that. Well, Lauren says it's very difficult once it gets hold of you. It's difficult to get out of it, but praise God, His grace is sufficient. And this dear lad today doesn't have one bitter bone in his body. He saw that the Lord was above it all. So bitterness. And here is the other side of the coin of bitterness. When Doug wrote asking me to speak on this subject, I haven't spoken on this subject. Well, I guess it's been about 8 years since I've spoken on it. And Bob mentioned to me when I was up here last, he said, "Well, you gave a message at such and such a conference on this." I went home, looked high and low, and I couldn't find my notes. I completely lost them.
That's so I wanted to preach on again. I couldn't find my
notes. So I kind of worked it out from scratch. And then on the last day, the last half day before I left Nairobi, I was rummaging through an old file and I found it. But I, in comparing the notes, I discovered that this is one I didn't have before. The fellows, I think, you know what that is?
Tyranny.
I really believe that there are some Christians today who have been greatly set back by the devil because they are reaping what they sowed. I think it's true that oftentimes there are people who turn bitter, but I think many times they're provoked to it. And Colossians 3:21 is an interesting thought. It's talking about families, and it says, "Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged." And fellas, if I am so hard on a guy and so insistent on things being my way that he just doesn't feel he has any room to breathe, he may go off bitter, and then I say, well, you know, there goes another bitter guy. And I don't realize that it was me having the spirit of tyranny that caused him to be bitter. D.E. Host, in this little book, If I Am to Lead, made this statement. He says, what is the essential difference between spurious and true Christian leadership? When a man, in virtue of an official position in the church, demands the obedience of another, irrespective of the latter's reason and conscience, this is the spirit of tyranny. When, on the other hand, by the exercise of tact and sympathy, by prayer, spiritual power, and sound wisdom, one Christian worker is able to influence and enlighten another so that the latter, through the medium of his own reason and conscience, is led to alter one course and adopt another. This is true spiritual leadership. If I Am to Lead by D.E. Host. If I get this person to come through the medium of his own reason and conscience, sometimes, fellas, that may take a little longer. It may take patience. It may take backing away and trying to work in a different way, but trying to salvage this guy and get his wholehearted cooperation. And I think that this fellow that I was talking about, one of the fellows I mentioned a few minutes ago that was extremely bitter, when he told his story to me, I sat and listened and I thought, well, if it happened the way you said, I think you were mishandled. And the other day as I was working on this message, and I wasn't even going to put this point in, and all of a sudden I looked back, and fellows, some of the stories that I've heard from bitter people about ways they were mishandled. I look back now and see the people who mishandle them, many of them are not walking with God. And let me tell you how this came to me so forcibly. I'm telling you, this was one of the most dynamic lessons that I think God ever just shoved right in my face. One night, in about 1964, Roger Fleming and I were in New York City, and we were doing public relations calls for the Navigators. And we had this card to go out and see a certain pastor. Well, that morning in my devotions, I had read this verse. In James 2:13, I had meditated on it. For he shall have judgment without mercy that hath shown no mercy. And mercy rejoiceth against judgment. Well, we went out to see this pastor, and we knocked on the door, and it was his mother. She came to the door, and she says, he's not here. And she said, he's over at such and such a school. And I remember Roger and I got in the car and we thought, well, he must be over to PTA meeting or something. So we went over and the school was dark. It was out on Long Island. And we drove, it was a private school, and we drove up through these grounds and the whole school building was dark except one light down in the basement. And so we got out of the car and locked it and walked over and walked down in the basement of this school building and looked around and didn't see anybody. And all of a sudden, here came the janitor, pushing a broom. Well, where's the pastor? And we introduced ourselves, and lo and behold, here was the pastor. And he heard we were from the Navigators, and man, he just had the joy of the Lord in his heart. He said, man, come in. So we sat down in the room where they keep all the soap and towels and brooms and everything, and I sat on a lid, and Roger sat here, and here sat this guy. We got acquainted, and he told back how he had met Doss back on the ship in the 1934, 5, somewhere in there. and how Dawson meant so much to him. And man, we were having great NAV fellowship. But in the back of my mind, I thought, pastor, janitor, basement of the school at night, what's all this? And then very humbly, he just began to unfold the story, how he had been married, had three or four children, had been a pastor of a church, had been struggling along. And then he told how one night, one day, he did something with one of his children, with his daughter. It was not immorality, but it was something that I just sat there and I, inwardly, I was doing like this. Am I hearing right? And because of this, his wife found out about it, and his wife sued him for divorce. They had him committed to a mental hospital. But when the doctor at the mental hospital examined him, the doctor said, well, I've talked with you and your wife, and I think really you're more sane, balanced mentally than your wife is right now. But nevertheless, she had sued him for divorce. And here he sat, and he was not in any way defending himself. He was being very open about it. Everything. But in my heart, as he was telling this story, I was saying, good night. No wonder your wife divorced you. And all of a sudden, just like a bullet, this verse from my quiet time that morning came into my heart. For he shall have judgment without mercy that has shown no mercy. And God just said to me, Jim White, you whitewashed sepulcher. Or as Oswald Chambers says, if you ever hear anything that anybody's done and it shocks you, it just is evidence that you have never really seen yourself as you really are, of your potential to do something much worse. And what God was saying to me was, here's a man that's right with me, and in your mind, you are condemning him. And someday, if you want mercy, you better give it. And I've thought about that over the years. One of these days, I'm going to be treated the way I treat my men. The way I treat people, someday, God doesn't settle his debts in a month or in a year, but I'm going to reap what I sow. And if I want judgment, if I want mercy and grace, I better give it. So, I'm not sure that's very clear, but what I was trying to get across, guys, is I believe that there are many today who are not walking with the Lord because, as Jeremiah 12 says, Jeremiah 12, 10 and 11, God says, many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness, and being desolate, it mourneth unto me. The whole land is made desolate because no man layeth it to heart. And in 1 Peter 5, 2 and 3, God says, not as being lords over God's heritage. So as we have these men on our team, we better remember that we're their shepherd as well as their leader. Then I think, a critical spirit. And by this I mean a loose tongue. Let's just pause for a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, thank you for Jesus Christ, and thank you, Lord, for the way in which you have kept us over the years, and the way you've given us a desire in our hearts to be obedient. And I just pray tonight that as we sit here in this meeting together, that, Lord, your Spirit will continue to minister to us. Help us, Lord, to have understanding. For Jesus' sake. One Christian leader made a tour of the mission fields of the world. He was the president of a missionary group. He toured all the mission fields of his particular group in the world. And when he got home, one of the executives in his mission said, "What did you discover to be the greatest hindrance to the ongoing of the work of the kingdom of God that you saw in all the fields?" And he says, "Well, I'll list three. Whisperings. And Dave and I were remarking one day down in Nairobi, we were having a little exercise together, and you know, I think that in Nairobi there's some wonderful godly missionaries. But we've been amazed at how some can just cut others down behind their backs. The wife of one Christian leader, Jerry sees her quite often. And Jerry came home one day, and I could tell she was really discouraged. And she says, "I have never yet been with this lady but what she doesn't cut somebody down in the conversation when we're together." For instance, that day in the meeting, there was a group of women meeting together. And this woman had been talking about one of the other members of the study group who wasn't there. And the lady just said, "Oh, she just sits home and gets fat." Well, she happened to have been a very heavy lady. And I think that, fellas, what causes this is it's an insecurity and an insensitivity it's an insecurity that tries to bring self up by pushing somebody else down. And by the way, it's something God hates. In Proverbs 6:16 through 19, he says, "These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him, and the seventh one is he who sows discord among brethren." And the Dohnavur Fellowship of India, they have this as their motto: "The absent shall be safe with us." The absent shall be safe with us. The absent shall be safe with us. Proverb 12:18 says, "There is that speaketh like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise is health." Proverb 12:18. The tongue of the wise is health. And just the other day before I left Nairobi, I was talking with my wife, Jerry, and I said, "Sweetheart, what can I pray for you?" And she thought for a long time, and she said, "Pray that I'll have a tongue that heals." I asked her, "Will you pray that for me too?" Several years ago, Bob Sparks and I were out in the Bay Area of California making finance calls for the Navigators, and I don't think you were with us this night, Bob. At least I don't remember you being in the car, but John Crawford and I were driving down Highway 99 from San Francisco to Fresno. And we had the radio on, and there was a radio preacher that was just really giving the business. He's very popular. I mean, not popular, but on many, many stations. Well, I guess he is popular. He wouldn't be on many stations. But he's just sort of off a little ways, or quite a ways on some things. And man, he was on this preaching, and we were sitting there listening to that, and when it was over, I reached over and turned the radio off, and for the next 10 minutes, I began to show my discernment. This guy's off on this and off on this, and all of a sudden, I looked over and I noticed John wasn't listening to me. And I got a little insecure, and I leaned over and I said, "Well, John, what do you think about this guy?" And he says, "Jim, why don't we just drop it?" See, John Crawford knew that there wasn't one thing in the world that our criticism could do to help that man sitting in that car. And he knew it would just breed a critical spirit. And I remember this happened one night at our table. We were sitting around the table having devotions, and all of a sudden, it was one of those nights when the fellowship was just warm. Man, we were just sitting for longer than the normal time, and just the Spirit of God was there, and the Word was being shared. And all of a sudden, a minister's name came up who is a very, very liberal minister in America. So all of a sudden, here I came again with my discernment. And I just began to list where this guy was off. And I'm telling you, it was as though the Holy Spirit just, or God allowed a bucket of cold water to be poured on that table. It was just as though Jesus Christ got up and left. And I just began to sense it. Now, I'm not even sure that the guy's a Christian. But I think God has so arranged it that he will not allow us to sit around his table fellowshipping with him and to have a critical spirit. And all of a sudden, I just said to everyone around the table, I don't know if you sensed it, but Jesus isn't here anymore. And I said, I want to apologize for the statements I made. And we prayed, and all of a sudden we felt in fellowship again. In this book that I mentioned the other morning, Frazier in Prayer, Mrs. Frazier tells how one night in a mission compound, she and her husband were sitting, and he went down to get a bite to eat or something in the kitchen. He was gone about 10 or 15 minutes, and when he came back, he was as white as a sheet. And she says, what's the matter? And he says, oh, nothing. I think I don't feel too well. And he went to bed. And the next day, a lady came up and she says, I want to apologize to you for the way I treated your husband last night. And she says, well, what do you mean, treated my husband? And she said, well, didn't he tell you? And Mrs. Frazier said, no, he came in and I noticed something was, he looked a little, you know, out of it, but he didn't say anything. And she said, well, when he came down in front of everybody, I read him off and shouted at him. And Mrs. Frazier said, well, no, he didn't tell me. So the lady apologized and she left. And so when J.O. Frazier came in, his wife said to him, why didn't you tell me about your words with Mrs. So-and-so, Miss So-and-so? And his comment was, I knew you always liked Miss So-and-Miss, and I knew that you would never feel the same toward her again if I told you. See, he didn't want to sow discord. And by the way, the next day, J.O. Frazier got a note of apology from this lady, and it was signed, Your Ardent Admirer. I knew you always liked Miss, and I knew you would never feel the same toward her again if I told you. So God give us that kind of spirit. And then it hardly needs commenting. But 1 Corinthians 7, 29-30, Paul says, I would that they that have wives be as though they had none. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. And fellows, you know illustrations as well as I do of many and many a man who started out to serve God, but because his wife didn't have the same heart with him, it just bound him up. And Doss Trotman used to say, there's only two people in the world that can hinder your ministry. Self, and the other is your wife. And so, boy, those of us who are married, we need to really make sure that we take the time to keep them alongside us and to keep the communications up. And then if you're not married, let's just make sure that we really wait on God to give us the wife that will help us be all we can for Him. And also, I think this
is a trap of the devil.
Now let me explain what I mean by that. Sloth. You could put down dishonesty. But what it is, it's carelessness and dishonesty with regard to money, time, or even your talents. But it's a carelessness with your stewardship. 2 Corinthians 8:21 says, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. 2 Corinthians 8:21. In Romans 12:11, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. And I believe that this is one of the reasons why the navigators ask us to keep a bookkeeping, a strict bookkeeping, so that the devil cannot get in and accuse you. I know one fellow today that had some navigator funds, and they were spent for something that they were not designated for, but for something else. And they were not paid back. And the fellow today, there's something just not right about his spiritual life. And I know a relative of mine that for years has bemoaned the fact, why doesn't God use me? He studies the Bible, he reads, he prays, he goes out and preaches, but nothing happens. But it so happens that a few years ago, he had declared bankruptcy. And I don't know if you know what the rules of bankruptcy are, but if you owe £1,000 and you declare bankruptcy, at least these are the rules in the United States, when you declare bankruptcy, they take everything, I think, but your house or something like that, but then from there on, your creditors can never come and collect from you. It's double rule. You can start all over. And this man owed people, but he has never taken the effort to pay back one cent of that money he owed. And he wonders, why doesn't God bless me? Whereas on the other hand, there's a Christian man down in Tennessee who was a partner in a business, and his partner gave him a raw deal and got him, I think, close to $1 million in debt in a deal, and then the guy ran out and left him with the bad debt. And there he was, almost $1 million in debt, and nothing to pay, and he had to declare bankruptcy to get the creditors off his back. He declared bankruptcy, and then immediately he started. He told God, God, if it takes till the day I die, I'll pay back as much as I can before I die. And God started blessing him when he made that decision, and by the time I met him, about 5 years ago, he had paid back that huge sum of money and was already on his way to amassing a great fortune of his own and had a great Christian testimony. But I think with God, little things are important, and honesty. Owe no man anything. And if you are handling the Lord's money and you can't give an accounting for it, the devil has a great big foothold in the door in which he can come in and accuse you. And that's why the navigators ask us to get an audit on our books each year, so that we can say to the world, if you want to look, here's where the money went. But sloth. And then last, health. Robert Murray McChane said, he was British, wasn't he?
Scottish.
Well, he, I understand he had his health broke, and he made a statement. I think this is almost verbatim. You can correct me if it isn't. But he said, God has given me a message to deliver and a horse to ride. I have killed the horse and now can no longer deliver the message. And I think, fellas, today that there are men of God, that they served the Lord, they burned out, but they can know they're still alive, but many of them can't do what they'd like to do because they were unwise in the way they kept their body up. So God help us to keep balance in our life on a physical as well as a spiritual level.